Live Bait, J.M. Walsh. There once was a man called Luce, who on occasion described himself as a collector. What he collected was not specified. It was a convenient, if designedly misleading label, one open to many misconstructions and interpretations. But its main virtue in his own eyes was that it was strictly accurate. For Mr. Luce preferred wherever possible to tell the truth about himself, and left nothing to deny later. That it was by no means the whole truth, or even a considerable portion of it, did not to his way of thinking affect the issue in the least. For he was a collector, of a kind. Mostly it was information of naval or military value that he sought. A pedant would have called him a spy. Mr. Luce could have countered that by pointing out that he seldom, if ever, engaged in espionage himself. It was his business to coordinate the results, and in due course pass them on to the right people. Most often plans were brought to him by those he believed he could trust. That their loss did no great harm is neither here nor there. The fact that Mr. Luce was able to acquire them at all meant that there had been carelessness or worse somewhere, and as a consequence, I have in mind one or two particular instances, there was a shuffling of personnel in one department and a tightening up of procedure in another. Luce was not the man's real name. Probably by this time even he himself could not have said offhand what that was. He changed his identity almost as often as he changed his clothes. Only in certain files of the power that employed him was there any immutable record. There he was known by a letter, a number, and a code word that had been added to the end of his dossier. But all this was years ago. A red line has since been drawn beneath the entry, and in a foreign hand and a foreign tongue a sentence has been appended intimating that he has fallen by the wayside. In other words, Mr. Luce tried once too often, overreached himself, and despite all his precautions, was caught. That his own power promptly disowned him goes without saying. Anyway, Luce would not have claimed its protection even had there been any hope of obtaining it. He had blundered with full knowledge of what would happen if he did, and had been left to pay the price of failure. Through the years of his imprisonment, they were not so long as they felt, he nourished two ambitions. One was to do something to rehabilitate himself, and the other, which gradually grew to be an obsession, was to exact payment from the man who had trapped him. One bright summer's day in the present year of grace, Sir Reginald Valery, Colonel Ormiston's departmental chief, sent for the Secret Service man, and the latter answered the summons with dismay in his heart. Such calls most often came at an inconvenient moment. For 2 years in succession, the holiday season had been spoiled for him by the inconsiderateness of foreign powers or their agents. One was on the occasion of the outbreak of the Spanish trouble, and the other... But there are reasons why the telling of that story must be postponed to a later year. Sir Reginald Valery began with apologies, for he knew by the look in Ormiston's eye that he had to be handled tactfully. He was quite capable of passing in his resignation if he was rubbed the wrong way, and despite the cant about no man being irreplaceable, he was far too valuable to lose because of a hasty word. Ormiston brushed the apologies dourly aside.
"Let's get to business, Reg," he said with the frankness of an old friend. "What do you want me for?"
Valery told him with commendable brevity. As everyone knew, there were things happening in the Mediterranean, repercussions of the Spanish trouble. A new supplementary naval code had been constructed and distributed to the Grand Fleet. Even though copies of it had been obtained by the wrong people, it was not possible, for administrative reasons, to alter it immediately. Ormiston seized on the operative word.
"Obtained?" he repeated. "What do you mean by that? Were they stolen?"
Valery shook his head.
"No, photographed," he said tersely.
Ormiston chewed thoughtfully over that. "But how?" he queried. "Did someone have access to them, or was there a leakage?"
He saw other possibilities that Valerie's explanation did not seem to have dealt with.
"Neither," Valery returned. "The work was done from the outside. A man posing as a window cleaner had a camera with a telephoto lens hidden in his bucket. He took a series of snaps of the room into which he was looking, and it was just our bad luck that this code of ours happened to be out on a table within range. Someone was consulting it at the moment."
Ormiston rubbed his chin thoughtfully. This didn't look too good. Abruptly, Valery reached into the drawer of his table, extracted something, then triumphantly fluttered a number of prints out fanwise in front of him.
"These," he said coolly, "are the photos that were taken, and here..." His hand went into the drawer again. "Are the negatives themselves?"
"All of them," Ormiston said shrewdly. The other nodded.
"Every single one of them," he answered. "We're sure of that." From under lowered lids, he watched the Secret Service man's reaction to the confession.
Well, said Ormiston after a barely perceptible pause, if you've got them back, there's no need for my services.
Valerie pursed his lips. I'm rather afraid there is, he said deliberately. Ormiston started slightly, then swiftly an idea came to him.
You haven't made an arrest by any chance? He asked.
Yes. Valerie spoke as though he had been waiting for that question. A man named Kioski.
Never heard of him, said Ormiston curtly.
I'm not surprised. He's new to us, too. His arrest came about quite by accident. He was going to the station in a taxi to catch a boat train to the continent, as we know now, and the machine he was in collided with a private car. The inevitable policeman appeared while the two drivers were trying to sort things out. The delay annoyed Kioski. He kept crying that he must catch the train, refused to answer any questions, and wanted to stalk off and get another taxi. When the policeman, quite politely, tried to stop him, Kioski lost his head and lashed out. He missed his train all right. People can't be allowed to assault policemen who are merely doing their duty.
Naturally, Ormiston smiled understandingly. I fancy I can guess the rest, he said. It was searched at the police station, and these, he nodded towards the prints and negatives, were found on him then.
Exactly, but there's a little more to it still. Valerie went on to relate what that was. In some way not specified, Kioski was induced to talk. Then it came out that he wasn't the principal by any means. He was merely acting under orders, those of Luss, to be precise. Luss had a copy of the code, it appeared. The arrangement he had made with Kioski was that if the man failed to notify him within 48 hours that he had effected delivery, Luss was to start off himself with his own copy. The notification was to be made by means of an advertisement to appear in the personal columns of three Parisian dailies. All Luss had to do was to buy whichever of the journals he preferred, which he could at practically any large bookstall in the home counties, within a few hours of the paper being issued.
He's made it as nearly foolproof as he possibly could, Ormiston grunted.
He has, but we know that Luss is still in the country and that he is hardly likely to be leaving for another 30 hours or so. You've got that time then to run him down and retrieve that copy of the code.
Ormiston smiled wryly. Isn't that more of a job for the police? He said gently.
I'm afraid not. Of course you will have all the cooperation from them that you need, but as you know, you can do things that the uniformed man dare not. Also, you're one of the few people who should be able to recognize Luss, no matter how he is disguised. You had enough to do with him the last time we got our hands on him. He had another reason, he might have added, though it was one he was reluctant to press on Ormiston. Luss was reputed to cherish an undying hatred for the one man who had ever trapped him. Valerie fancied that something of value might yet emerge from that single fact.
2.
Colonel Ormiston bent down to knock the ashes from his pipe against the side of the empty grate. In the very act of straightening up, he paused, then swiftly ducked his head again. That action, in all probability, saved his life, for something swished through the air not a foot above the top of his skull, hit the side of the fireplace, and dropped with a faint thud on the tiles. Ormiston's reaction was characteristic of the man. He twisted abruptly sideways out of his chair so that he was no longer in a direct line between the open window and the fireless grate. At the same instant, a revolver appeared as if by magic in his hand. Three quick strides took him across the room. Reaching gingerly from behind the shelter of the curtains on one side of the window, he drew the sash swiftly down. Then he peered out. As he had expected, the prospect was deserted. There was no sign of any intruder in the garden now. But the topmost twigs of the laurel bush against the fence still moved perceptibly, and at the sight he smiled grimly. The hidden marksman had gone that way, as quickly and as silently as he must have come. His haste had been such that he had not even remained to see the effect of his shot. Perhaps he was egotistical enough to assume that there would be no need for a second one. More probably, he had been disturbed at his work and had managed to make himself scarce just in time. Ormiston felt that there was little to be gained by attempting to pursue his assailant. Since he had not caught even so much as a glimpse of the man, identification of him in his present incarceration was not going to be easy. As a strict matter of fact, he abandoned the idea of pursuit before it had begun to take tangible form. Instead, he turned back to the more hopefully interesting business of examining the missile that had just failed to put a period to his existence. All the same, it was with a view to what he called improbable possibilities that he moved so that he was able to keep one eye on the window while the other was occupied in another direction. The unknown and unseen might or might not return. That was something on which Ormiston preferred to keep a deliberately open mind. But should the fellow reappear by any chance, the Secret Service man meant to be so placed that the next shot would be fired by, not at, him. The object that had just missed him was a tiny silver dart with a feather of fluffed-out red-coloured silk-like material at one end. The other was pointed, and at first glance looked as though it had been dipped in glue. Ormiston picked it up gingerly between two matchstalks, which he manipulated like a pair of pincers, stared hard at the dirty brown blob on the point, and whistled soundlessly. Next, he placed the dart carefully on a sheet of paper, one of the several on the tabletop, and the red fluff seemed to glow up at him like a malignant eye. Then, and not till then, did he open the door, thrust his head out into the hall, and call for his companion.
"Terry," he cried, "I want you."
Though his voice was decidedly low-pitched, he somehow contrived to fling into it a note of urgency that he believed was bound to reach the other's ears. He was not wrong in this. Almost immediately, he was answered from above.
"Coming," said a crisp voice, and the soft, swift clatter of feet on the stairs advertised that for once Terry was speaking the literal truth.
He burst into the room like a young whirlwind, then stopped dead, and his jaw sagged at the sight of the revolver in his brother-in-law's hand.
"What's up now?" he demanded jerkily. "Don't tell me you've called me down to witness you committing suicide. This lost business isn't quite so hopeless as all that."
"I know it isn't," Ormiston said steadily. Nevertheless, the corners of his mouth twitched slightly. For so understanding a man, it was odd that this was the nearest he ever got to a smile. In a different voice, he went on.
"Terry, what were you doing upstairs?"
Terry's eyes widened, but...
"Snoozing,"
he said promptly. "It seemed such a delightfully drowsy afternoon that I thought it was a pity to waste it. Why?"
Ormiston brushed the question aside with a gesture of impatience. He had some others of his own to ask before he answered Terry's. "You didn't happen to be looking out of the window of your room, say, within the last 5 minutes or so?" he queried.
Terry, immensely serious now, his shrewd dark eyes raking the other's lean, suntanned face, slowly shook his head.
"No, I didn't," he declared. "Would I have seen anything had I been?"
Ormiston gave a curt little nod.
"I should imagine so," he said. "As a matter of fact, I've had a visitor. This is the kind of card he left me."
He pointed to the shining dart on the table. Terry started forward, put out his hand, and went to touch it.
"Don't leave it alone," Ormiston snarled.
His voice was so startlingly harsh that Terry froze abruptly in his tracks. Then curiously, he turned his head to look at the other.
"What's wrong with it?" he demanded. "It looks like an airgun dart to me."
"So it does to me," said Ormiston with feeling. "But its real name is Death. You see, it was intended for me."
Quickly, he explained the circumstances of its arrival.
"Loss," said Terry laconically at the end.
"You think so?"
"There's little room for doubt. Anyway, he hasn't lost much time getting to work. It can't be much over an hour since you left Valerie."
"He could hardly have known that I'd been there," Ormiston said thoughtfully. "Still, one always has to allow for the possibility of coincidence. He might have seen me in the neighborhood and deduced the rest. The one thing about which I can feel certain is that he doesn't yet know the Kioski has been pulled in. He would have been on the run before this if that was the case."
"With descriptions of him circulating all over the place, it shouldn't be long before his turn comes," Terry opined.
"It's not so easy as all that," Ormiston protested. "Luce is a past master at disguise. That's why he has been able to keep going with impunity for so long. All the same, he has one or two little peculiarities that I fancy may give him away if I ever clap eyes on him again."
Terry nodded. That, he surmised, was one of the two reasons why an attack had been made on Ormiston. Luce could never feel altogether safe anywhere as long as the Secret Service man remained alive. Terry was turning away with some idea of scouting through the garden. Perhaps the laurel bush or its vicinity might offer him something in the nature of a clue, when his eye fell on one of the sheets of paper on the table, and he pulled up short.
"What the deuce have you been doing there?" he asked in a voice suddenly gone husky. "Isn't it a breach of the Official Secrets Act, or whatever you call it, for you to have documents of that nature in your possession?"
"This."
Ormiston picked up one of the sheets in question. It was a neat little blueprint, apparently, of the very latest thing in anti-aircraft guns.
"Rather nicely done, isn't it? Valerie has quite a few more like it. I may tell you something about them someday."
Terry stared at him. "You'd better be careful with it," he said warningly, and there was something oddly pinched about his face now. "Suppose Lusa killed you and got away with this? What then?
It would have been awkward, Ormiston said gravely. That struck me at the time. Anyway, I have a rooted objection to being killed wantonly, he added with seeming inconsequence.
Terry's brow furrowed. There was a puzzle here whose depths he could not quite fathom.
He did not press the matter further, however. It was fairly obvious from Ormiston's manner that he was in no mood to answer questions about procedure. All the same,
how do you propose to get onto Lucy's track? Terry asked anxiously. Ormiston's glance did not waver in the least.
I don't propose, he said surprisingly.
Then? But Terry left the sentence unfinished.
There is a popular superstition, Terry, Ormiston said meaningly, to the effect that lightning doesn't strike twice in the same spot. I am hoping that Luce has never heard of it, or if he has common sense enough not to believe it. For one long second he held the other's eyes with his own. Then Terry gasped audibly. All at once, understanding had come to him.
3.
There was no moon. It would not have mattered much had there been one. The clouds that had gathered earlier in the evening now completely blacked out the stars. Truly, the gods were being good to him, thought the man who slipped like a gaunt shadow from behind the masking growth of the laurel bush. He could hardly have had a night more suited for his purpose had he ordered it specially well in advance. There was no sign of life in the house. The last light had gone out more than an hour before. No servants slept on the premises, that he knew. There were only 2 men with whom he would have to deal, for the women folk were away for the week. All this he had ascertained by careful, painstaking research. The final item of information that he needed had come to his hands only that very evening, and with its receipt, the last piece of his plan had clicked neatly into place. His procedure was peculiar. He made a cautious circuit of the house. He stopped at every door, found the keyhole, or if it was a lock of the Yale type, fumbled for a clear space beneath the door. But into whatever opening it was that he located, he inserted a length of rubber piping. The other end clamped over a weapon curiously like a Luger pistol, except that its muzzle was inclined to be bell-shaped. On each occasion when he pressed the trigger, there was no more than a faint hissing sound that died away as he plugged the keyhole or the space beneath the door with a handful of earth. At last he finished. Then he turned his attention to effecting an entry. This he did through a window at the rear of the house, which he found conveniently unfastened. Had he stopped to think, he might have felt inclined to regard this as suspicious, but he took it in his stride. If he thought about it at all, it was to accept it as a piece of carelessness that played right into his hands. But before he climbed through the window, he slipped on his face a gas mask that he had taken from under his coat. The interior of the house was dark and silent. The light from his torch jetted round as he attempted to recall the geography of the place. Once he stopped as he passed the foot of the stairs and he hesitated for a second. Then he raised the pistol and fired twice into the gloom above him. 2 faint tinkles followed on each other's heels as the little glass bombs the pistol had ejected struck the floor of the landing overhead. Beneath the mask, the man chuckled softly. He himself walked in an invisible sea of death, safe for the time being. Anyone aroused by his movements who came out onto the landing above would almost certainly sway and choke, then topple to the floor. But even if that failed, no one could come down the stairs without risking dissolution. With some difficulty, he located the room in which Ormiston had been sitting at the moment of the attack on the afternoon of that very day. His preparations were quick and thorough. He made sure that the curtains were drawn across the window, that the catch was fast. Then, just to make assurance doubly sure, he tilted the back of the chair under the handle of the door. No matter how he had miscalculated, he could hardly be taken unawares now. He worked for close onto an hour in a darkness punctuated only by the stabbing gleam of his pocket torch. At the end, he had the little wall safe open, and he thrust his hand in. There was only one thing there, 2 sections of cardboard clamped together by elastic bands. He slipped off the latter, and his eyes twinkled. The little blueprints he had glimpsed through the window that afternoon lay there for the taking. The cardboard that had protected them he threw into the empty grate. The plans themselves he thrust deep into an inside pocket. It had been easier even than he had dared hope. From first to last, luck had been with him. He had come that afternoon in order to kill, and chance had shown him how he could do that and at the same time turn a moment's carelessness to advantage. It remained only for him to get out of the house now. He had no intention of departing by the way he had come. There was no need for that. Cautiously, he drew the curtains aside just enough to allow him to peer out. The garden was empty, deserted, not even a shadow stirred. Very, very gently, with a facile ease born of long experience in the art, he began to raise the window inch by inch. To his immense relief, it moved soundlessly. When the aperture was large enough to allow him to crawl through it, he stopped, flung one leg over the sill, followed with the other, and gave a sigh of heartfelt gratitude as he felt the soft soil of the garden beneath his feet. Meticulous always, he turned and closed the window before moving from the spot. He took half a dozen paces forward, then thought of the gas mask still clamped to his nose. He tore it off and gulped in the sweet fresh air of the night. It struck him, however, that he had better get rid of it at once. It was a useless encumbrance now, and he might yet have to move with haste. He was looking round for some convenient bush in which to fling it, when he fancied he heard a faint sound behind him. Then he felt a touch on his shoulder.
"Hands up, Luce," snapped a voice with a parade ground rasp in it. He whirled with an inarticulate cry, and the brilliant beam of a large hand torch struck him full in the face. For the moment he was blinded, then, as his vision cleared, he recognized Colonel Ormiston and saw the ugly-looking automatic he held in a rock-steady hand. Behind the colonel were other shadowy figures. Luce groaned. The game was up. He had walked into a trap. 4. A room in the house was cleared, and when the gas had been dissipated, the little party entered. Luce, handcuffed now, glared round at Ormiston, Terry, and the couple of men from the special branch who had helped to rope him in. The senior of the latter was speaking to Ormiston in a low voice. "I've phoned," he said. "Our men will go through this house with a fine-tooth comb. If there's a copy of that code hidden there, they'll find it." Ormiston nodded approval. "And they'll let us know the result promptly," he said with a shade of anxiety in his voice. "They'll telephone through to here the moment they find anything," the man assured Ormiston. "You can trust them on a job of this sort, Colonel, you know that. They don't miss much, and they work with an amazing celerity. They have to." Once again, Ormiston nodded. He turned to the table where the things they had taken from Luce's pockets made a neat little pile. On the top was an envelope addressed to a Mr. Buller. The letter it had contained, innocuous in itself, was ample evidence that this was Luce's latest alias. More. The superscription had told them where the man had been lodging. The proper course, so Terry thought, would have been to take Luce off to the police station and there charge him. Ormiston thought differently, and since he had been given a free hand in the matter, it was his word that counted. Had he been asked to state the reasons why he hesitated, he would have found some difficulty in marshalling them. All he could say was that something, instinct, if you like, warned him that the incident had not yet reached a climax. There was more to come, but what, or in what way, he could not say. Luce must have caught something of what had passed between Ormiston and the man from the special branch. The glum look cleared from his face, was replaced by something curiously like triumph. "What do you think you're going to find at my place, Ormiston?" he demanded, twisting round. "You know as well as I do," Ormiston retorted.
Luce grinned openly.
"Perhaps I do, but I'm not telling."
"Listen," Ormiston took a step nearer to him. "It's a copy of that supplementary code."
Luce's face went blank.
"What the devil are you talking about?" he said.
"Don't pretend you're innocent," Ormiston snapped back. "The gaff's been blown, Luce. Kioski's told us all he knew."
"Kioski?"
Luce's face was a study in amazement.
"Why, I've never even heard of the man."
"No?"
Ormiston's tone had suddenly become dangerously quiet.
"That's queer. We roped him in this morning."
Briefly, pungently, he outlined what had happened. Luce took the blow without winking. Even now he was prepared to brazen it out, though his object was not very apparent.
"I repeat," he said at the end, "that I don't know anyone of that name, and if he says I do, he's a liar."
"Perhaps."
But there was not so much certainty in Ormiston's voice this time. He quite realized that it might not be so easy to prove to the satisfaction of a jury.
"Listen," Ormiston's voice tensed. "I set a trap for you, with live bait in it, myself. You walked right into it. I guess that before you left England for good, you tried to even up old scores with me."
"I'm damn well sorry I didn't succeed,"
Luce snarled. "I can believe that, but you bungled both times. This afternoon you missed me as near as don't matter with that poison dart of yours. If your aim had only equaled your daring, there might have been a different tale to tell. But I imagine that something distracted your attention at the crucial moment. What was it?"
Never mind, I'm not telling.
Perhaps I can guess, but we'll come to that later. Again tonight you made the mistake of assuming that we were in the house. We weren't. In anticipation of a visit from you, we got outside, kept ourselves concealed until it was time to pounce on you. So despite that remarkably efficient little gas pistol of yours, we're still alive.
But only just, Luz spat at him. And talking of people assuming things, I'm not the only one who has made a mistake, Zatvei.
Ormiston jerked to attention.
What do you mean? He demanded in a hard voice.
Luz laughed in his face.
Find out, he said.
I'll make you talk, Ormiston threatened.
You can't. Not in England. You're not allowed to grill a man here.
Ormiston's face went an ugly red. At that exact moment, a bell rang somewhere in the house.
The telephone, Terry said startlingly.
The special branch man jumped to his feet.
That'll be the boys, he said. I'll answer it.
Ormiston hesitated.
All right, he said the next instant. Be careful, though. That gas should be all cleared away by now. Still, you never know.
The man nodded, went out. 2 minutes later, he returned. His face now wore a crestfallen look.
I've searched everywhere, he announced. Practically pulled the place to pieces, and they found just nothing.
Ormiston sat down heavily. Luz grinned in open triumph.
I told you, he said.
Terry watched him curiously. He had the feeling now that Luz meant to use the missing copy of the code as something with which to strike a bargain. Perhaps in the last resort he would barter it for his liberty. Through Ormiston's heart, a dreadful feeling stabbed. They had caught Luz, but all their work would count for nothing if the code got out of the country. Unless he could make the man speak, they would be worse off than ever. He wished now that he had not invoked the help of the special branch. He and Terry should have handled the whole affair on their own. Had there been no outsiders present, the two Secret Service men between them would have found some way of opening Luce's lips. But he dared not propose anything now that savored in the least of third-degree methods.
How big, said Terry suddenly, would the paper be on which the code would be copied?
It was something that he had never thought of asking until this very moment. Despite the mixed way in which he put the question, Ormiston guessed what was in his mind.
It wouldn't take up so very much room, Terry, if that's what you're thinking about, he said. It's not a complete code by any means. That sort fills a small volume, you know. But this is only a number of supplementary alterations and additions dictated by exigencies that have only recently arisen. I should have made that plain to you at the start.
So it wouldn't take up much room at all, Terry said thoughtfully. It could be comfortably inscribed on both sides of a couple of sheets of writing paper.
Less than that, said Ormiston unhappily.
Out of the corner of his eye, he had been watching Luz, and saw the man's mouth open, then close abruptly again, as though the fellow had been on the point of interrupting, and had immediately thought better of it. He wondered irritably what it was that had been said to catch the man's attention. He swung round, and raked him with a withering glance. But Luz merely grinned evilly, with a show of white and perfect teeth, the significance of which did not at once strike Ormiston. Then suddenly he jerked upright. The Luz he had handled on that historic occasion in the past had been in rather more need of dental treatment.
Luz, he said in the easy tone of one who is merely bent on satisfying an idle curiosity, you've had your teeth out since I last saw you, haven't you? Those you've got now look to be false, aren't they?
Some queer apprehensive spark seemed to flicker in the other's eyes for an instant, and as quickly died away.
Well, what of it? He said defensively. There's nothing wrong in that, is there?
I should hope not, Ormiston said virtuously,
and would have added more had not Terry gasped suddenly. All eyes flashed to him as he flung himself across the room onto Luz. What followed was never quite clear as far as details were concerned. The one fact that emerged was that somehow Terry had managed to get his hand into Luz's mouth, and the two of them were struggling violently.
Hold him, you fellows,
Ormiston's voice cut into the chaos. Terry lurched back abruptly. His fingers were clutching an uppercase denture.
Luz, with a dark, malignant look on his face, was plunging in the hands of his captors like a maddened steer.
Let me at him, he said thickly.
The so-and-so swine's bitten me, Terry said ruefully. It'll be rotten luck if I've got the wrong lot and have to give him the chance of another bite. Even a dog isn't legally entitled to more than one.
Terry, what the hell? Here, talk sense.
I am.
Terry was prodding over the denture now, seemed to be trying to take it to pieces. Suddenly some of the teeth parted from the vulcanite, swung sideways as though on a pivot.
Has anyone got a pin, please?
Terry asked in a mild, self-satisfied voice. This set seems to be hollow. I wondered why it felt so thick. someone produced the pin and Terry set to work. In next to no time, with its help, he had extracted something from the hollow between the two plates of vulcanite with the dexterity with which the devotee harpoons a winkle. It was a tightly rolled wad of paper, apparently. Ormiston took the exhibit from him and unrolled it. It was extremely thin yet quite strong paper, of a sort that could be compressed into a surprisingly small space and yet remain of reasonable length and width. Back and front it was covered with writing in a microscopically small hand. Ormiston dived on his desk, snatched open a drawer, seized a reading glass and examined the paper in detail. Luss plunged like a frightened horse. His mouth worked oddly. He looked as though he were going to have a fit. Ormiston dropped the reading glass back in the drawer.
"This is it," he cried excitedly. "There's no longer any doubt whatsoever about it."
Had any still lingered in his mind, Luss's behavior would have been sufficient to banish it. Now that it had become evident that the game was up, the man showed signs of going to pieces. Perhaps he realized at last the position in which he stood. There was no longer any hope for him. Ormiston folded the paper carefully, put it into his wallet, and slid that into an inside pocket. The chief of the special branch man looked up expectantly, but failed to catch Ormiston's eye. Luss had that temporarily.
"You win, Colonel," he said huskily. "Or rather, it was that infernal brother-in-law of yours."
He looked balefully at Terry. Terry met the glance with a cheerful grin.
"I think," said Ormiston carefully, "that I know what it was that distracted your attention when you fired at me this afternoon."
He crossed to the table and took up the little blueprints Luss had found in the safe.
"These?" he said questioningly.
Luss nodded. He could not trust himself to speak now. Ormiston looked at the prints a moment, then, very slowly and methodically, tore them across and tossed the pieces into the empty fireplace. Terry gave a smothered exclamation of protest.
"It's all right," said Ormiston calmly. "They're only fakes. They, too, were bait of a kind."
The prisoner parted his lips in a sickly grin. He had lost all along the line.